Good evening and welcome. My name is Ethan Womble, and I'm the president of the Georgetown Law Student Chapter of the Federalist Society. On behalf of our chapter, welcome to the 13th annual presentation of our Lifetime Service Award. Tonight is the culminating event for what has been a very active year for our chapter. When this year started, we had a goal to grow our membership and continue the great work that chapters before us had done. Thanks to the hard work of our executive board and members that I see out here tonight, we have done that, hosting over 37 events over the course of the year. These events covered topics like policing the police, the travel ban, Masterpiece Cake Shop, the Electoral College, the deep state as a byproduct of the administrative state, self-regulation in the sharing economy, Title IX reform, just to name a few. And in March, we were fortunate to host the Federalist Society's 2018 National Student Symposium here at Georgetown Law, a student-focused academic conference over the course of 2 days, which culminated in a keynote address from Justice Clarence Thomas. Through our local audiences, live stream viewers, and podcast listeners for all of these events, we reached thousands of people with our panels, discussions, and debates. All of these events were designed to bring attention to the core principles of the Federalist Society, that the state exists to preserve freedom, that separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that is emphatically the duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what the law should be. In that same vein, our annual Lifetime Service Award is an award our chapter gives to an individual who has embodied these core principles through public service. We started the award in 2004 and have tried to award it every year since. A full list of the past award recipients is located on the back page of your programs. We are very pleased to award this year's Lifetime Service Award to Senator Rand Paul. Before we do so, I'd like to thank Senator Paul for accepting this award and taking time out of his busy schedule to be here with us tonight. Thank you to the members of our faculty, Randy Barnett, David Hyman, and Sean Hopwood, who are here with us tonight and serve as mentors to our chapter here at Georgetown. Thank you to our alumni chapter for publicizing this event, and we welcome our alumni members in the audience tonight. I'd also like to thank the Article I Initiative at the Federalist Society for their sponsorship of our event tonight. The mission of the Article I Initiative is to restore Congress to its rightful place in the constitutional order. You can learn more about the initiative and other events like this one at fedsoc.org. For anyone interested, they will be sponsoring the 6th annual Executive Branch Review Conference tomorrow at the Mayflower Hotel, and admission is free. Lastly, I would like to thank Ryan McNulty, our Director of Events, for putting this event together. Ryan interned for Senator Paul's office last year, so I know he's excited to be presenting the award to the Senator tonight, and I'm pleased to call him up to do that now. Ryan?
Thank you, Ethan. This event is the capstone of our year for the Federalist Society. And you just heard Ethan run through all the great events we put on, including the National Symposium. And I just want to say that none of that would be possible without the great leadership of Ethan Womble. He really took our chapter to a new height this year. And so, Ethan, thank you very much for that. In 2010, and again in 2016, the people of Kentucky elected Rand Paul to serve in the United States Senate. During his time in the Senate, Senator Paul has been an ardent defender of constitutional liberties and fiscal responsibility. One of the most principled people in Washington, he has consistently fought to return the government to its limited constitutional scope as envisioned by the framers. As a result of his commitment to this cause, Senator Paul has shined a spotlight on some of the most important national issues of our time. For example, we all remember in 2013, Senator Paul brought to the forefront the question of whether drones can target American citizens without due process when he spoke on the floor of the Senate for nearly 13 hours. And of course, there are numerous other issues that he has championed, such as privacy, fiscal responsibility, transparency in the Federal Reserve, and the proper scope of Congress's power under Article I. Before coming to Washington, Senator Paul owned his own ophthalmology practice, where he performed eye surgeries for 18 years. During his free time, he still provides pro bono eye surgeries for needy families in Kentucky. He currently resides in Bowling Green, Kentucky, with his wife of 25 years, Kelly. They have 3 sons, William, Duncan, and Robert. I had the pleasure of interning for Senator Paul as a law clerk in the fall of 2017. I'll never forget the first assignment they gave me. They handed me a bill coming down the legislative pipeline and asked me to flag any potential Fourth Amendment issues I might find in this bill. I remember before I dove in thinking to myself, what if every policymaker in Washington began with the question of whether the policy under consideration is authorized by the Constitution as written in the first place. My guess is that our government would look very different today. Senator Paul, I speak on behalf of our entire Georgetown chapter when I say that your career in the Senate thus far has inspired us. Day in and day out, we watch you stand up on the Senate floor and in the committee hearing rooms, raising issues such as separation of powers, federalism, liberty, and the rule of law that are fundamental to our constitutional order, but so often go undiscussed in Congress and even in the public at large. As we are about to, in a few minutes, we learn from you substantively, but even more importantly, you are a living example of why it is so important to stand up for our founding principles, even sometimes when we may be standing alone. For your commitment to liberty, separation of powers, and the rule of law, it is my honor, on behalf of the Georgetown Law Chapter of the Federalist Society, to present to you the 2018 Lifetime Service Award.
Well, thank you very much. There's probably nothing more satisfying for a physician to get an award from lawyers and then to be able to say, you know what, I get to lecture a bunch of lawyers and future lawyers about the law. It also might be a little bit presumptuous to think I know as much as Georgetown law professors and students, and so I won't claim to know as much, but I know this much. I know just enough to get me in trouble, and so I'll make every attempt to get in a little bit of trouble with this. When I think about, you know, our Constitution, our founders, I think about the genius of the founders. Probably the biggest thing that I think they bequeathed us is really the separation of powers. And it really was. We were going to have these checks and balances, and no one branch would get too strong by checking and balancing. As you look at government now, though, you might be disappointed and say, well, how come it's not working? You know, so Madison said we would pit ambition against ambition, and the short answer is Congress seems to have no ambition. They seem to have no ambition to check the executive branch. It isn't so much sort of a jockeying back and forth between the legislative and the judiciary, although there's some of that, but it's really the power has all aggravated to one branch of government. The executive branch has become enormously large. Now, our founders were not big fans of democracy, and I think it's important. It's a question I ask whether you're in fifth grade or in law school. I ask everybody, are we a democracy or a republic? You guys obviously know this, but a lot of people in the rest of the public don't quite understand the difference between democracy and a republic. But our founders did, and they put in really a lot of rules to make sure we weren't a democracy. They hated the idea. I mean, not just disliked, they abhorred, they hated, they detested the idea of a democracy. And so they put in supermajority rule. We have supermajorities for a lot of things. We have two senators from each state, no matter how populous. That's an undemocratic sort of reform in there. To get a constitutional amendment passed, you have a supermajority. The filibuster empowers the minority. The presidential veto is once again sort of taking power away from the majority. And you say, well, why would they hate majorities? Why would they hate democracies? Well, you know, throughout our history, you can look at the times when we've succumbed to majority rule without restraint or without an understanding of liberty or rights. Probably the most common thing would be all the Jim Crow legislation that was passed after the Civil War, you know, for the 30 or 40 or 50 years after that or even longer. And it's a point that I try to make often is that majority rule is not necessarily a good thing. Our founding fathers knew that. Everybody knows the Franklin quote about, you know, democracy being two wolves and a lamb, you know, voting on what they'll have for lunch, and liberty is a well-armed lamb, you know, contesting the vote. Jefferson talked about how majority rule was nothing more than mob rule. 51% would take away the rights from 49%. Madison said the same, and said that really that our personal security, our rights, and our property are not really secure. And yet, last week we had a hearing on whether or not we would approve Pompeo. And you can have mixed feelings. You can either be pro or con on Pompeo's nomination. But one of the questions troubled me, and this was from a Republican senator, and he said, is spreading democracy in our national interest? And the first thing that jars me is we're not a democracy. Why would we be spreading something that was abhorrent to our founding fathers? Do we know so little about our history that we would be doing that? Not to mention that the founding fathers wouldn't have been for militarily advancing the ideas of even a republic overseas. But it's jarring to hear that coming from a congressional hearing. Our founding fathers did fear power, basically, the concentration of power. They feared that maybe that power would be in the hands of the few, but they also feared unlimited power in the hands of the many. They saw democracy as unlimited power, or possibly unlimited power in the hands of the many. They feared that even, you know, those who say, well, Hamilton, you know, he wanted a bigger, stronger government. But even Hamilton said, if we incline too much to democracy, we shall shoot into a monarchy or some other form of dictatorship. Really universally throughout, you know, these are the Federalists. Look at the Anti-Federalists. They were even more horrified by the power of government. So this is the majority back then that won the battle over the Constitution, and virtually every one of them was concerned about too much power, too much concentration of power, and also about the idea of democracy. So when we look at our country, we say, well, what's the goal? What should be the goal? Are we going to spread democracy? Are we going to spread republic? What is the goal? And I would say that the goal is liberty. And I think it's one of the things that I've learned from reading some of Professor Barnett's book and others is that, you know, with our Constitution, the idea should be about presuming liberty, that we begin with liberty. We don't begin with the government being right. We presume that you have something that Judge Napolitano refers to as comes from our humanity. It's innate. It's either God-given. It's somehow part of us, pre-existing all government. But that there's a duty somehow of the courts to actually presume this idea of liberty. And I think it's become, you know, there's been this discussion I hear sort of on the periphery. I haven't been to any of the National Federalist meetings, but I believe there's been this discussion, this idea about judicial restraint versus judicial engagement, this idea of presumption of constitutionality. And I think it all sort of came to a head and became more apparent to sort of the lay public and to those of us who are not lawyers when we read Justice Roberts' opinion in Obamacare. And I think Damon Root put it very well. And he says, so judicial restraint reared its head. In fact, as an authority for his deferential maneuvering, Roberts turned to none other than Justice Holmes, citing the famous juror's concurring opinion in the 1928 case of Blodgett versus Holden, which declared, between two possible interpretations of a statute, by one of which it would be unconstitutional and the other valid, our plain duty is to adopt that which will save the act. And I love his conclusion. He says, in other words, the tie goes to the government. And I was thinking about that ruling when I went to a dinner a couple months ago at the Library of Congress. And as many of you know, it's rare that you get to ask a justice a question. You know, if you're a lawyer before in the court, if you're Randy Barnett, you're standing up there, you might get asked questions. It's very limited in the question and the timing and probably what he can ask. And yet, I got to ask a question. He was doing a book interview, and David Rubenstein was interviewing him. And during his introduction, he said, well, he asked him about the nominating process. And he said, well, the nominating process, I just told the legislators that a justice should be like an umpire. You just call balls and strikes, and you try to be impartial. You try not to be wedded to ideology one way or the other. And that sounds really good. It sounds like probably that'd be a good definition. So I raised my hand at the end. I don't know if he saw this coming or not, but I said, well, I like, you know, the idea that it would be, you know, an umpire, that a justice would be an umpire. But I said, you know, don't you think maybe you tilt justice or put a finger on the scale if you presume that all the laws are constitutional? Doesn't sound like you're an umpire anymore. It sounds like you've already sort of put your finger on the scale. It's not like it could be constitutional or not, and I'm going to examine it based on the origins and the text and all of these things that our founders talked about, but you're going to go ahead and presume that it's constitutional. And he smiled a little bit, and he responded, and he had a really long answer. I can't remember the answer, but mostly that's how lawyers do it. They or accountants. Lawyers are accountants. They put you to sleep with their answer and you never can figure out what they were saying. But the bottom line is he was saying this: there's a lot of precedent to the presumption of constitutionality. And I guess for me, in looking at this and looking and talking about the presumption of liberty, I probably care a lot less about precedent than I should. I'm sure I should care more about it because I guess I care so much about liberty that I think really there should be this presumption of liberty, and a lot of the decision-making should be based not only what our founders wanted, but really on what liberty is. And people say, well, who gets to decide that? And I had this conversation with Scalia one time, once again at a party where he was trying to get away from me. But, you know, I asked him about, you know, the whole idea that there are rights that are not enumerated and, you know, they're not to be disparaged. And he says, who's disparaging those rights? And I said, well, you know, just the idea that you have a right to privacy. It's not in there, but Ninth Amendment says if it's, you know, not listed doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's not to be disparaged. And I think that's still a big question we have. And conservatives tended to get all upset that rights were being created in this penumbra and all this stuff. And it's like, so they got really hostile to this idea that everything had to be there. But I don't think anybody, I mean, this was a big deal. You know, Madison's opposition to the whole having a Bill of Rights was that he thought people, you know, if they saw a list of rights, would all of a sudden think that's all there were. And so the Ninth Amendment was a big deal to him to put that in there. So hey, Roberts didn't particularly like my question that much, but we got through it. And before I let him answer, you know, I asked him whether he was tilting the scales. And I said, well, you know, when you think about it and you think about whether or not, let's just say, I don't think anybody when I asked the question knew what I was talking about because this was a bunch of legislators. And so I asked him about the presumption of constitutionality tipping the balance and nobody knew I was getting to Obamacare. And then I said, but you know, what if the government argues that a regulation is constitutional under the Commerce Clause? And then the court concludes that no, but then they presume if there is a way, we must find it constitutional, even if we must call it a tax. Haven't you gone from being an impartial umpire towards tilting the scales of justice towards legislative dominance? And then I think a few people in the audience began to know that I was asking him about Obamacare. And like I say, I got a long-winded answer that it was just precedent. And I think that's a bit of a cop-out, frankly. Sometimes people ask me, they say, have your core beliefs changed in a way? And I think it's a good question because all of us, you know, in politics, we get really strong beliefs and we get elected, and has anything changed? And I would say if anything has probably changed over time, it's been my understanding of states' rights. And some of that's thanks to Professor Barnett as well as others, Timothy Sandifer and others who have written about this, Judge Napolitano as well. But the idea that conservatives were sort of, we were always states' rights, everything is states' rights, and because it seems to be it's a smaller form of government, so we should be for it. And yet, a lot of bad things were justified under states' rights, and there still are people out there that are the consistent states' rights people saying Brown was wrongly decided and that, you know, really states can do whatever they want. And it's to some of us is like, well, that doesn't seem like something I really believe in, that, you know, we could have separate but equal or segregation and all of these things. And I guess as I began to look at and read about the 14th Amendment, I became more and more convinced that in some ways it's like the First Amendment. I was reading it the other day, and I was struck by the idea that it says no state shall do something. And the First Amendment says Congress shall not pass a law doing something, you know, speech and assembly, et cetera. But I was struck by the fact that it's really about individual rights, and it's about protecting individual rights, due process, equal protection. We wish privileges and immunities maybe someday. But the idea that it's really about that, and so for some conservatives, they're like, oh, the 14th Amendment's going too far. Now you've let the federal government, you're restricting states' rights. But then if you read some of the history and you read like Calhoun and about his states' rights and you read, you know, basically he was talking about a government that no conservative in their right mind would want. It was a government that had enormous power, not only over owning individuals, but didn't really sound like small government. And this gets to this point that we talk about sometime when we talk about, you know, federalism. And Professor Barnett talks about some of the evolution of federalism, but to me, if I want to put it in simple terms, I think about it just being the 10th Amendment, that those powers not given to the federal government are left to the states and people. But the question is, should, you know, what are these powers? And so when I think of the 14th Amendment, is it a limitation on the powers, the enumerated powers of state government? Not really. It's sort of defining an enumerated right. So you divide sort of three categories of enumerated rights, and you say the states can't do something about these enumerated rights. And I guess to me, I see it as a protection of individual liberty. And it is, there's this supremacy thing, oh, well, the federal government can now come and invade state government and state law. But then again, which is the higher purpose? This concept that states have rights, or the fact that individuals have rights? And so to me, it becomes an easy call, and I think some conservatives haven't quite gotten there yet, but I think it's an important issue that I think over time my understanding has evolved some. Now, when we talk about federalism, though, we often have people that are jumping up and down, and once they call it federalism, you're supposed to be for it. And so we had Graham Cassidy that came before us. And you remember that was an Obamacare replacement put forward by Republicans. Now, to me, the short description of it is it kept most of the federal Obamacare taxes and let the state spend it. So if we think back to the 14th Amendment and states' rights and stuff, do I really care about state government doing it versus the federal government? I'm a little more concerned about the individual and the marketplace. And to me, it just wasn't that exciting. And frankly, didn't think it was much of federalism. But the vice president came to our lunch one day, and he was, you know, waxing poetic about how this was federalism. And I said, well, no, I think federalism would be this. We tell the states, we don't tell them they can't have Obamacare, but they would raise the taxes, and then they would spend the money on it. In fact, federalism, when we talk about block grants, and there have been times in my life when I'm kind of like, well, block grants are better than what we have, but in some ways they might be worse than what we have. If the federal government or the federal officials suffer the vicissitudes of voting for a tax increase, but then the people spending the money don't have to vote for the tax increase, it's a lot easier to spend money that somebody else has raised the taxes for. Maybe you need both in the same body. So maybe federalism being, you know, devolving to a smaller governmental unit would be good. I'm for that. But I'm not so sure I'm for the federal government taxing people, because up here and the money coming from us, and then it just gets spent down there. Because one of the things that makes state government better than federal government is they don't have a printing press. So we have a printing press and virtually unlimited borrowing potential. So there's a real problem. We're going to tax the people. It's not going to be enough. And then we'll borrow. Where's the restraint there? And the whole argument about block granting Obamacare was, oh, but they'll be spending it more efficiently. But we'll still have 90% of Obamacare. It's just now going to be devolved to the states. It just didn't excite me that much, but I didn't think it really was federalism either. One of the things that I don't get yelled at very often in the airport, but not too long ago, I had a woman come up to me and she said, do your job. And I was like, all right, but what is my job? And I think it's an important question, because people have different understanding of what the job of their legislature is. Some think the job is passing laws, and that's what we're elected to do. We should be passing laws. I guess I would argue that really what we're elected to do is protect liberty. And you say, well, that's pretty vague. What does that mean? Well, I think we have a robust discussion over what liberty is and what government should do, but I don't think it's always about passing laws. And in fact, when this woman came up to me, I actually thought back to sort of the quote from Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative, where he said, and if I should later be attacked for neglecting my constituents' interests, I shall reply that I was informed that their main interest is liberty. And in that cause, I'm doing the very best that I can. So I think when you get to the heart of liberty and you talk about, you know, blocking everything out, and you talk about, well, what are the important things? Are we ever doing anything important up here? Are we ever discussing the Constitution? Well, you'd be forgiven for thinking we aren't, because the news media is consumed with everything else other than substantive news. But I think there are times at which we are, and I'll give you a couple of examples over the last months and even years where I think we do discuss important principles, and it's why I get on a plane every week and come back, and it's why I come and talk to people, because I think these are important principles. And someday, if one of you in the audience is a representative, I hope that you'll think, I'm going there not because I'm going to get some money from one group and give it to another group. I'm going to go up there to discuss constitutional principles and try to argue in favor of liberty. But, you know, we have a debate on occasion on whether or not the president can go to war without a declaration of war. We had it just 2 weeks ago. Mike Lee and I teamed up with Bernie Sanders and Chris Murphy. There's a good crew, right and left, coming together. And Bernie Sanders made a point, and it's a pretty good point. He said this because he was turning the knife a little on the Republicans. He says, you guys are always talking about the rule of law. You're always talking about the Constitution until it comes to war, and then you just completely ignore it. And he's exactly right. We're always about original intent, what the founders think, till it comes to foreign policy, because everything they thought about foreign policy is the opposite of what the neoconservatives and really, frankly, the liberal conservatives, the other side. You know, there really wasn't much difference between Hillary Clinton and John McCain. There really isn't. You think there's a lot of difference? Hillary Clinton never met an intervention she wasn't for. She was the key voice in the last administration for going into Libya and bombing Libya. That became a disaster. She was the same thing with Syria. So you think there's a difference in right and left? There sometimes is, but sometimes the people that are, you think, more towards the middle are, and they're more the same. But we do have that debate. We lost. We had the debate because the administration, this current administration, argued that the war in Yemen is not hostilities, that bombs don't equate to hostilities. And they also argued that, well, we have some people there. We have several hundred soldiers in Yemen, and they are fighting, but they're not fighting against the Houthis. They're fighting against al-Qaeda, and we got permission after 9/11 to go after al-Qaeda. Absolutely untrue. Al-Qaeda is never mentioned in the proclamation after 9/11. We were supposed to go after the people who planned, plotted, attacked us, aided and abetted them. Nobody in Yemen did. I promise you. A cousin of a cousin of a cousin, nobody did. And I asked Pompeo this the other day in the hearing. I said, who's left? Tell me the name of one person left who plotted to attack us. We have people now fighting in our wars that weren't born before 9/11. Our soldiers are now getting to the point where they're going to be going to Afghanistan and fighting. The other question I asked Pompeo, I said, and he admitted this, and so does Trump, and so does Mattis, for that matter, that there is no military solution to Afghanistan. Well, raise your hand if you're excited about going to Afghanistan when there's no military solution, that you want to take up your musket and go and walk over minefields and IEDs when there's no military solution. We are fighting basically a little bit like when we did in Vietnam to tip the balance to get a better negotiation. So the Taliban have 40%. So what we should tell all of our enlisted people that we're sending over there, you are fighting to see if we can get the Taliban down to 30% so they'll negotiate a better peace with the crooks that run the government in Afghanistan, the ones who sell poppy for money and are involved with the drug trade. You know the one reason the people over there like the Taliban better? Some of them do. They're very harsh. They'll chop your hand off. But at the same time, they're not crooks with regard to justice. Their justice seems to be very harsh and swift, and some people actually choose it. Not saying it's a good thing. It's a terrible world. But realize, why does 40% of Afghanistan want them? Because the other people are crooks. And really, is there something we can do about that? We do discuss it. We don't get anywhere on declaration of war, but there is a small remnant of us who believe that Congress should declare war and authorize it. Another big question that has constitutional ramifications is the idea of indefinite detention. This was passed in 2011 and says that an American can be arrested, accused of a crime in our country, not overseas, not in a battlefield, in our country, but they could be detained indefinitely. President Obama recognized this was a terrible power, and he says, this power is so horrific, I will never use it. Like, did he think he was going to be president forever? You know, I think that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I heard it. I remember a mayor in my town saying that one time after the Kelo case. She says, but I'm a good person. I won't take your land. We won't use it for private purpose. We're not going to take your condo and give it to a drug company. But it's like, it's not about you. It's about the next mayor. That's what government's about. It's not about you saying you're a good person. It's about the rules restraining us against when we get a really bad person elected. So we've been fighting on indefinite detention. The last time we had a vote was 6 years ago, but it's still in my top three or four things I'd like to have a vote on, is whether or not an American can be detained without representation, without a trial. It's very important. People say it's never been used. Yes, but it's still an incredibly important right, the idea that you get a trial by jury. Fourth Amendment, we've been fighting this for a long time. And you need to realize, and I think you do, that technology has allowed your government to have such an ability to gather things technologically that there's almost nothing they can't gather, that we do have to consider and probably move forward. I think Maryland versus Smith was wrongly decided. I'm not too wedded to precedent. I'm ready to overturn Rand, you know, I'm ready to overturn Maryland versus Smith. And there's a great dissent there. I can't quote it verbatim, but from Marshall, about that privacy is not sort of discreetly packeted and can be taken away. So there always have been people who understand this, but we have to go one step further. And I think the court has a right-left continuum now. I'm hoping that the Carpenter case will represent some of that when it comes forward, that perhaps Gorsuch and maybe Sotomayor are able to come together and see some defense. But I think you don't give up a right necessarily to your information when you let somebody else hold it. I think you can have a user agreement, like you might have an agreement with Facebook. One of the questions I thought nobody asked, which is the most important question, and I don't know the answer because nobody asked the question, did Facebook violate their user agreement? I mean, people are mad about what they do with it, but the internet, the whole internet operates on selling information. If you order shoes and you look at shoes that look like these shoes, which are really great, by the way, they will keep showing you picture of these shoes until you buy them. That's what the internet is. And you kind of agree to that. But if you didn't agree to have to have them diving into your email, which I think Facebook does, because I signed up for a fake account recently, I've gotten like 500 people want to be my friends. I don't even have my name on it. I don't have any identifying information. I'm pretty sure they're dipping into my email. Anybody sent me and then any of their friends of friends. But I'm in the thousands of people want to be my friend. I didn't put a real name or any kind of identifying information. And I don't know if that's in my agreement or not. If it's in my agreement, pity the fool that didn't read the agreement, but if it's not in the agreement, then they should be held liable. Talk about a big case. Y'all can't graduate soon enough. Class action against Facebook, that's a big case. And while I'm not always a big fan of that, if they broke their agreement, I think it's something, that's how they should be punished. But everybody in Congress just talks about whether we should regulate them as if it's just should we regulate them or shouldn't we? The real question is, did they break their contract? And I don't think anybody really got to the scope of that. The final thing I think that we don't really look enough at, but some of us do, is that when we vote on spending bills, it's not about how big or small or whether the budget balances, although it is to a certain extent. It's really about whether or not we're spending money on things the Constitution has given us the power to do. If there isn't an enumerated power to doing what we're doing, we'd probably have a much smaller government and our fiscal problems would be fixed. But ultimately, I think what we're talking about, no matter which constitutional issue we're talking about, ultimately it all gravitates back to how much power do you want your government to have over you. I think the antithesis of liberty is government power. I think Lord Acton had it right that power corrupts. I think Lincoln had it right when he said that any man can stand adversity, but if you want to challenge a man, give him power. I think part of our role as legislature should be to explore the size and scope of government. And I think our founders really did fear concentration of government. During my father's career, I think no one was a keener critic of concentration of government, and I'd like to finish with this. He wrote a farewell speech in 1984. It was a little premature, he came back again, then wrote another farewell speech. But I like the one from 1984. He said, "Thousands of men and women have come and gone here in our country's history, and except for the few, most go unnoticed and remain nameless in the pages of history, as I'm sure I will be." This is before it became really famous. "The few who are remembered are those who grab the reins of power and for the most part use that power to the detriment of the nation. We must remember that achieving power is never the goal sought by a truly free society. Dissipation of power is the objective of those who love liberty." So I'm not sure I can improve on that, but what I do know is that I need help and we need more defenders of liberty. We are in a decided minority. I think fighting for intangibles such as liberty is always harder than fighting for largesse. People can see and touch an Obama phone, but liberty is less concrete and more of an aspiration than a good. But I think liberty is worth the fight. I appreciate the award, and I hope you'll join me in that cause of liberty. Thank you. Remember, I'm just a doctor, so don't give me any hard questions.
Check. Is this on? Is it good? Okay. Senator, thank you again for being here with us this evening. We have a couple questions for members of the audience, so if you don't mind. Concerning the Article 1 duties and responsibilities assigned to the legislative branch at the founding, what troubles you most about how the Congress is currently operating?
I think that they completely ignore any constitutional restraint. I don't think there's probably five people in the Senate who would ever even ask the question. My dad used to say that there are two arguments that no one will listen to in Washington, a moral argument or a constitutional one. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. I don't think do you think anybody on the appropriations committees is saying, "Oh, well, wonder where the constitutional authority is for doing that?" No, they just spend money. And so it's why government's gotten so big, and it's really part of the problem. If we obeyed the Constitution, you'd have a government probably not even half the size we have. And you might have a government 20% of the size. And if you really wanted government, you could have it at your state level, which might be more efficient. And there really isn't a constitutional provision saying the state governments can't do things.
As you said in the beginning of your remarks, the founders believed that separation of powers would ensure that ambition would counteract ambition. However, we have seen in recent decades that Congress in particular has not followed the founders' expectations. Why do you think that is, and what can we do about it?
Laziness is part of it, but having no ambition is part of being lazy. But really, it's also because if it's on foreign policy, our founding fathers, you know, one of my favorite Madison quotes is that the executive branch is the branch most prone to war, and therefore the founders studied the question and vested that power in the legislature. They really didn't want the executive to be able to go to war. It's very clear from all the founding fathers. You can go through all the Federalist Papers. Anybody that ever wrote about foreign policy was they did not want a king. They didn't want a powerful president to go to war. And yet nobody believes that anymore. So you've got, you know, the McCains and Grahams who believe basically they now talk about a unitary president. They talk about unitary power, which means unlimited power. They say he has Article 2 authority to do it. So when we had this debate over bombing Syria, that's what they say. The president can do whatever he wants in foreign policy. It's not historic. It has nothing to do with what the founders said. It has nothing to do with what was written. But in that case, it's not really laziness. It's just that most people up here are for it. You know, people ask me today, what are you going to do about, you know, the president bombing Syria? And it's like, I can't do anything unless if there were a majority of people who believed that he shouldn't, we could. But even then, the separation of powers kind of breaks down to a certain degree when a president does what he wants, because all legislation requires him to sign it. So it really, you still could, you know, not fund things. But, and this is what Graham and McCain will argue. They say, oh, you have the power to stop war, just don't fund it. But it's much more difficult to not fund people who, you know, when the soldiers are out in the field and you say, oh, you're not going to buy them bullets. You know, so it's much more difficult. Even at the height of the unhappiness with Vietnam, they had one committee vote to defund the war in like 75 or something, a month before it ended. But they really never were bold enough to defund it. But some of it's because I think they agree with policy, but some of it's maybe a lack of understanding of how the checks and balances are supposed to work.
How would you incentivize current members of Congress to take greater individual responsibility for strengthening the proper role of the legislative branch? For example, would you support a constitutional amendment imposing term limits for Congress?
Yes. I would also cut the pay in half and have us up here half as much and require that you have a real job outside of government.
That's a great answer. Why do you support the RAINS Act, and can you explain how it would impact congressional authority?
All right. The RAINS Act says that any regulation over a certain dollar amount that's written by unelected people of the executive branch would have to come back and be voted on. And really, if you're talking about how big a problem we are, one of the biggest problems we have is the separation of powers is broken down. But as a consequence of the breakdown, the executive branch has become enormous and enormously powerful. And you also now have people that are not responsive to voters writing, one regulation can be more important than any law voted on. I mean, there are regulations that cost the economy, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so the RAINS Act would change this and would sort of give legislative oversight. The other way you could do this is as you're writing regulations, you could specifically not give the power to the bureaucracy. But we typically write such vague legislation that's sort of an outline, like Obamacare was an outline. That was part of its problem. Obamacare, I think, the bill said 1,800 times the Secretary of Health shall decide at a later date. That's too much power. And it's laziness and it's speed. We got to get done. And then they don't write things properly. But we also write an outline of what's going to happen. Then we let the regulators do it. So once again, it's lack of ambition on the congressional part to actually say we should be telling the bureaucrats what to do.
This is a related question. How do we encourage Congress to be more specific when they're legislating so that they leave less opportunity for the independent interpretations from executive agencies?
you know, voting a significant number of people out of office, you know, that, you know, nothing wakes people up more than the threat of losing office. Term limits would help as well. Some people complain about term limits and say, oh, the staff will be too much too powerful. And I see some of mine sitting over here would have to limit their terms too. And I think that, you know, because there are some people who have been up here a long time and the senator, let's say, is not working at peak performing levels like they once did, and the staff basically run those offices. And so none of the solutions are perfect, other than I think it helps to have more people who have had a career outside of government. If you've always been up here, this is the only possible you know, and they just can't think of that there's any other possible. And they can't think, like, we haven't done appropriation bills but four times in 40 years, so everybody says it's impossible, we just can't do it. That's not true. It could easily be done. If the leadership sat in the chair of the Senate and said, on day one, we're going to do all 12 appropriation bills, we're going to spend the first 3 months in committee. At the end of 3 months, every committee will vote an appropriation bill, and then we will spend 2 weeks on the floor on every bill. There's plenty of time to do it. But they don't want to do it, because really the reason we've gotten to the situation where we lurch from deadline to deadline, we have these enormous bills that nobody read, they want it that way. They act as if they don't. But what happens when one person's in charge of the bill and has to negotiate with one other person, or what, you know, it's usually the Republican leader negotiates with the Democrat leader who negotiates with the president. Those three people have all the power, nobody else has it. What do you think happens in a special interest situation where people give money to those who have power? All the money accumulates to people in leadership. And it used to be more money would go to, like, chairman of committees, which wasn't perfect, but now it's not even that. All the money goes to leadership, because leadership's the only one that can cut you a deal. And then people like me who say, I'm not voting for that piece of you-know-what, have less power, because I'm not willing to play the game to try to get something inserted in there, and then they don't listen to me because they know I'm not going to vote for, you know, busting the budget caps and trillion-dollar annual deficits. But there is some hypocrisy, and some of it's playing out. So you saw the House the other day vote for a balanced budget amendment. The AP asked me about it, and they said, do you think it's hypocritical for them to do that after just busting the caps? And I said, yeah, they should be required to stand on the floor of the House and say, yes, I voted for the omnibus, I'm a hypocrite, but I'm still voting for the balanced budget amendment. And that would work. That would shame a few of them. So nobody took me up on that.
What are your views on earmarks? Should the current ban remain, or could the practice be reformed in such a way that would be transparent and beneficial?
I think earmarks led to bad things. I think towards the end, the transportation bill had like 6,000 earmarks on it. The countervailing argument has some substance to it, though, and that is that you're giving up the power to designate where the money's spent to the president, who then simply puts his or her earmark on things. I think that may happen some, but it's not happening like it once was. I mean, it used to be, you know, if your mother was a donor of mine, big donor, Mrs. Smith, and she wanted a, you know, Mrs. Smith's genealogy museum to her family, all of a sudden there's $500,000 and we got Mrs. Smith's genealogy museum in some remote town somewhere. And so there were a lot of abuses of it. Also, the money flowed to the big appropriators who were on the committee, and still some use of that, but less so. I think there's a way you could designate how money is spent with rules, with very detailed rules, but don't specify specific projects. So I think Congress could do more, but once again, Congress doesn't write very complete bills, so they haven't figured out yet that even without earmarks, they could write more detailed rules. Like, I have a bridge I want built in northern Kentucky, and it's 50 years old, and it's falling apart, and we need a new one. You could probably write the rules such that we need to do and they're probably supposed to do this anyway, a traffic count, the age of the, you could put like a list of 10 things that have to be decided so we don't build a brand new bridge in New York just because someone's a leader, you know, in leadership for New York. And there's still some of that goes on, you know. But writing more complete bills, I think, is part of it.
Two more questions. What changes, if any, would you like to see implemented in the Senate chamber, which would be most beneficial to how it operates?
You know, the argument from the House is we should get rid of the filibuster. And I think for executive appointments, I've been for making it easier to get some of the executive appointments through, speeding up the debate, because we still have like a third of President Trump's nominees just sort of languishing out there because we're taking so long. So on the executive calendar for nominations, I'm kind of more for speeding the process up. On the legislative side, many conservatives in the House are very critical of the filibuster the president is. They want to get rid of the filibuster. Nothing can get done. But in a 250-year history of our country, I think there have been more bad ideas than good. And it goes back to our founders' intent. They didn't want, their goal wasn't to get rid of gridlock so we could have 400 bills pass every year. Their goal was to protect liberty. And I still think by keeping the process slow and requiring more unanimity, you probably are protecting liberty better that way.
Well, the last question was whether you're in favor of speeding up post-cloture debate time. So
on the executive branch, yes.
So if everybody would join me in thanking Senator Paul for being here.